Upon This Rock, the 14th talk in a series entitled The Mind of Christ, was presented by Ron Julian on April 10, 2011, at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2011. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
We're in week 14 of our series called The Mind of Christ. Our goal in this series has been to explore some of the major themes in the teaching of Jesus. And in the last several weeks, we've been on a particular theme. We've been looking at the reasons Jesus gave that people should accept his claims to be the Messiah. Why should we believe this at all? First, we saw that he pointed to his miracles as a sign from God that God had sent him. Then he pointed to the coherence between his own teaching and that of the Old Testament, so the wisdom and coherence with the teaching of the Scriptures. And then he pointed to the Old Testament prophecies that pointed to exactly the kind of Messiah Jesus turned out to be. So that's a pretty strong picture. But for you and me, there is a further issue. We didn't see Jesus do any of these miracles, and Jesus didn't even write a book or a letter spelling out any of his teaching. We have nothing directly from him. So on what basis do we accept the claims of Jesus? Us, you and me. Does Jesus himself teach anything about our situation? So you understand, again, I'm not taking on that big topic as a whole. The issue is, did Jesus himself have anything to say about that? That is, does he speak about what would happen after he was gone with the people that never met him in the flesh? Well, actually, he talked a lot about what would happen after he was gone, and we can sum up his answer in one word, apostles. So that's what we're going to talk about today, what Jesus taught about the apostles, his chosen representatives, and what they ought to mean to us. So I'm going to ask you to bear with me today. There are a lot of aspects to the way that Jesus dealt with the apostles, and in my first version of this talk, I tried organizing everything into categories with key quotations for each point and everything, and it was just a mess. It was just awful. That this is not the way to go about this. We're going to all die. So today I decided to start instead by just telling a story. This is the story of Jesus and his apostles, a highly selective story. I'm not going to quote anything or mention any verse numbers, but I want to paint a picture with the story of Jesus and his apostles, what Jesus said about what he was doing there, and then we will get down to some specifics afterwards. But first, just allow me to say a bunch of stuff that I'm not going to prove. When Jesus started his ministry, he clearly was already thinking about what was going to happen after he was gone. I mean, this is not a case of a guy who wandered around saying some things, and then afterwards a group of people got together and say, hey, I know, let's start a religion about that guy. I mean, Jesus from the beginning had in mind what was going to happen after he left. He had many disciples, that is, he had many people who followed him around, listening to his teaching, wanting to be students of his teaching about God and the Scriptures. But from among those disciples, he chose 12. And he called them apostles. The word apostle means something like a representative or ambassador. An apostle is one who has been sent out by someone else to speak on their behalf. So what might happen when a king sends a representative to a part of his kingdom and that representative shows up and says, this is what the king says? That's an apostle. That's someone who has a sent one. Someone who has been sent by someone else to speak for him. That's what Jesus called them. And having chosen these men, Jesus spent the rest of his time here on earth preparing them to be his ambassadors. It was a large part of what he did. The major part of their training, of course, was just the simple fact that they saw it all. When Jesus did a miracle, they saw him do the miracle. When he taught, they heard what he had to say. So a large part of their experience was just the fact that they were there to hear his teaching and to see the miracles that he performed, to see the arguments he got into with the Pharisees and so on. Jesus, however, did many things that were aimed specifically at the apostles, that were intended to train them up for the role that they were going to have. For example, he did one thing that always used to surprise me when I read it in the Gospels. He sent the apostles out in pairs to preach around Judea. Well, the reason it surprised me is they didn't know anything. I mean, he sent them out to preach, but this was before they had gotten to the spot where they had figured out what the gospel was all about and everything. I mean, when you look at the way they interact with Jesus when they come back after they've been sent out, you realize that they really didn't have much of a clue as to what was going on. But what did they preach then? So he sent them out to preach. What did they preach? Well, it says in the Gospels that Jesus' initial message as he went around Judea was, "Repent, for the kingdom of heaven is at hand." Well, that's exactly what it says that the apostles preached when he sent them out in pairs. "The kingdom of heaven is at hand, and all men everywhere must repent." That was their message, the same message that Jesus had. Probably they didn't understand much else. I would imagine that they probably said, "We're here representing our master Jesus, and he says that the kingdom of God is at hand, and everyone must repent." And they were probably hoping that people didn't have too many questions, because they probably couldn't have answered them. But what was happening for them is they were essentially kind of getting practice here, going out and speaking for Jesus, because that ultimately was the role that they were going to have when Jesus left. So along with the preaching that they did when they were sent out, Jesus also gave the apostles the authority to do miracles. When he sends them out, he says, "Heal the sick, raise the dead, cleanse the lepers, cast out demons." I don't think, and I may have missed it, but I don't think Jesus ever really explains why the apostles were to do miracles, but he explains his own miracles as a sign from God, as a testimony from God through these miraculous events that God was putting his stamp of approval on Jesus, that God had sent him. So presumably the miracles of the apostles showed that Jesus had sent them. As they went out, excuse me, as they went out, the miracles said that God endorsed their message, and their message was, "We are speaking for the man Jesus whom God sent." So Jesus' miracles showed that God had sent him. The apostles' miracles showed that Jesus had sent them. And that fits very well with what we see later in the New Testament when the apostles are talking about the signs and wonders that they did. That's exactly the sort of argument that they made, was that this was a demonstration that they were speaking for Jesus. He sent them out on their own, carrying no supplies. They were supposed to trust God, depend on the kindness of the people that they met, preach the coming kingdom, and do miraculous signs. They went out and did that, and then they came back and reported to Jesus all that had happened when they went out to do that. So we have a very obvious sort of training session, I think, that Jesus has sent them out on. We also see Jesus taking opportunities along the way to get the disciples thinking about the work of ministry. I'm thinking here of the story in John 4 where Jesus has an encounter with a Samaritan woman, and what he says to her basically gets her so excited and worked up that she goes back to town and says, "I've been talking to this guy, and he told me everything that I've ever done. Do you think this couldn't be like the Messiah, could it?" And so while she's gone, the disciples come up, and they say to Jesus, "Hey, we got some food." And Jesus, in his usually cryptic way, responds back, "You know, I have food to eat that you don't know about. which they totally misunderstand, as they do everything he says. And you can't entirely blame them because it's very hard to figure out what he's saying sometimes. But he comes back at them, "My food is to do the work of the one who sent me." So Jesus is saying to his disciples, basically, you know what I find nourishing and satisfying? It is doing the work that God sent me to do, proclaiming the gospel to people. Look around. Look at these Samaritans here. They're ready for what we have to tell them. And why does Jesus do this? I mean, he's just been talking to the Samaritan woman. Why does he tweak the minds of the disciples here a little bit? Well, he's trying to inspire them with the same vision to seek the same satisfaction in preaching the gospel that he has. It's just this little interlude between the time the woman left and the time she brings back the whole village. But Jesus takes that time to inspire the apostles with a vision of the work that is going to be their future life. This is what they're going to be doing. And he just takes that moment to give them a taste of why it's important. The Gospels are filled with stories about Jesus interacting with his apostles. They had a lot of questions that they were always asking him. Jesus, why can't we cast out this demon? Jesus, this village just told us to get lost. Do you want us to summon fire from heaven and wipe them out? Jesus, why do you teach in parables all the time? Why don't you just tell them what you mean? Jesus, what do you mean you're going to die? That can't be true. Jesus, what will be the sign of your coming and of the end of the age? And in each case, Jesus usually has to step in and correct the presuppositions that led to the question in the first place. They usually don't understand the situation, and he has to back up and reorient them to what's really going on. There was one issue that was clearly very important to the disciples because it came up several times. And that question is, who among us is the greatest? This was a very important question to them because on more than one occasion, Jesus catches them fighting with each other over who's the most important among them. And once, one of their mothers gets involved in the deal. The mother of John and James comes to Jesus, and she's basically lobbying for her sons to be Jesus' right and left-hand men. Basically saying, when you come in your kingdom, can they like sit on either side of you? So, this was a big deal. They were really concerned about who's going to be the top dog. Okay, Jesus is the top dog, but then who's going to be the top dog? And I think it's very important to Jesus that he deal with this issue for them because they are going to be his representatives. And whenever you have authority, as they are going to have, you have the temptation to use that authority to feel important and better than others. Authority is a real temptation to us. It gives us that sense of, I'm somebody because I've got authority that they don't. So Jesus talks to them about this a lot. One time he tells them that they shouldn't be like the Gentile rulers who lord it over their subjects. And other times he tells them they should be like children. He tells them that the one who is greatest in the kingdom of heaven is the one who is the servant to everyone else. And most importantly, he points to his own example. Jesus is the Messiah, and yet he served others to the point of laying down his own life for them. On the last night he was with them, you'll remember, he girded himself like a servant and washed their feet. And then he told them, "Look, you're probably wondering why I did that. Well, you have called me teacher and Lord, and you're right. That's who I am. So if I, your Lord and Master, acted as your servant, then that is how you should act toward each other." So we can see, to the end, Jesus was training them in how they should conduct themselves as ministers of the gospel, as the representatives that he was going to make them. Now, many of these lessons that he was giving them are relevant to us as disciples. We are disciples. We all need to be servants, just as he was teaching them. Many of the questions that the apostles had are also our questions as well. But some of what Jesus said to the apostles applies uniquely to them. They are apostles and we're not. And that's the stuff that I want to talk more about right now, is the fact that Jesus was preparing these men to be apostles, to be his appointed representatives. They were to have a unique role, a role that none of us here have. So what was that role? What is it that he said about what he was preparing them to do? And I think this is very important to us, because you and I not only have to decide how to think about Jesus, we have to decide how to think about the apostles as well. So, what did Jesus say about the apostles? What were they to do? How should we think about them? First of all, Jesus was going to send them out to be teachers on his behalf. After the resurrection, we see Jesus saying this to the disciples very clearly in the famous part from Matthew 28, the Great Commission. Go therefore and make disciples of all the nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father and the Son and the Holy Spirit, teaching them to observe all that I commanded you. And what I want to concentrate here on are those words, make disciples and teaching them to observe all that I commanded you. It is going to be the task of the disciples to teach Jesus' message. They are going to make disciples for Jesus. Jesus is going to have more students, but Jesus is not going to directly teach these new disciples. The apostles are going to be teaching for Jesus. They will teach what Jesus taught. So they are going to go out and make disciples for Jesus, teaching them what they got from Jesus, so that the people that they are making disciples will be learning from Jesus through them. This was going to be their task. Why do we know anything about Jesus, you and I? Jesus never wrote a word, as far as we know. We know about him because of his apostles. Peter told us about him, and John told us about him. Luke says that he interviewed the eyewitnesses when he wrote his gospel. And Paul, who was not a part of the original group of the apostles, says that Jesus himself came to Paul and taught him the gospel that he proclaimed. So, one way or another, the apostles are those who are coming along and telling us what Jesus was about, what he taught, what he wanted us to know. They are the representatives who are teaching on his behalf. So that's exactly what Jesus described would happen. The men that he chose to represent him to the world actually did go on and do that very thing. And you and I are among the disciples that they made for Jesus. You and I are students of Jesus. But we are students of Jesus through the teaching of the apostles. If they hadn't taught, we wouldn't have a Jesus to study. Jesus also said of them that they would have authority. That's implicit in the idea of being an apostle, I think. When a king sends out a representative, an ambassador, that ambassador speaks with the authority of the king. Most of the time, the ambassador just repeats what the king has proclaimed. So the ambassador goes out and says, this is what the king says. And we listen to the ambassador because the king told him, and now he's telling you. If a decision must be made, though, if that ambassador is out away from the palace and something must be decided in that spot, the ambassador must have a thorough understanding of the king's purposes. He makes decisions in accordance with the values that the king has passed on to him. And this, I would argue, is the nature of the authority that Jesus describes the apostles that they're going to have. There's probably the most foundational passage for this is found in Matthew 16, which has a lot of details that we won't go into, but let's look at that. Matthew 16, verse 13. Matthew 16, 13. Now when Jesus came into the district of Caesarea Philippi, he began asking his disciples, saying, who do people say that the Son of Man is? And they said, some say John the Baptist, and others Elijah, but still others Jeremiah, or one of the prophets. He said to them, but who do you say that I am? And Simon Peter answered and said, "You are the Christ, the Son of the living God." And Jesus answered and said to him, "Blessed are you, Simon Bar-Jonah, because flesh and blood did not reveal this to you, but my Father who is in heaven. And I also say to you that you are Peter, and upon this rock I will build my church, and the gates of Hades shall not overpower it. I will give you the keys of the kingdom of heaven, and whatever you shall bind on earth shall be bound in heaven, and whatever you shall loose on earth shall be loosed in heaven." Okay, this is a highly debated passage, of course. Roman Catholics base their idea of the Pope on this passage, the arguing over the keys of the kingdom, and in what sense is Peter the rock that the church is built on, and so on. Let me just make a few observations about this passage. What is it that Jesus says here about Peter's confession of faith? He says that flesh and blood did not reveal this to Peter. That is, this is not an idea that Peter came up with by consulting various human authorities. He didn't go to the leading Old Testament scholars and say, "Okay, let's sit out and figure out who this Jesus guy is." Instead, the Spirit of God himself was at work in Peter's understanding. Now, I think it would be wrong to see this as just sort of as that Jesus is saying God just sort of popped into Peter's head. He doesn't even know where the idea came from, the idea that Jesus was the Messiah. I don't think that wouldn't fit the picture that we see. Peter had seen a lot. He was very well aware of the possibility that Jesus might be the Messiah. He had heard what John the Baptist had said. Everybody was talking about this Jesus guy. Everywhere they went, there were people who were saying, "So is this guy the Messiah or what?" The Pharisees were asking, "So are you the Christ?" We see that the disciples had talked amongst themselves and had decided that Jesus was the Messiah. So Peter considered everything that he had seen and heard, and the power of God worked in his understanding so that he really got it. He really understood and embraced the idea that Jesus was the Christ. He had committed himself to that truth, and it was because God was at work in his understanding that came to that place. Jack has been very helpful to me in thinking about this passage. It was that, I think, that miraculous God-given understanding of who Jesus was that Jesus was commending in Peter. That's why Peter was going to be the rock on which the church was built, because the church was going to be built on the foundation of the God-given understanding of the Messiah that God had imparted to Peter and, by extension, to the rest of the apostles. That's why the keys of the kingdom will be his. That's why it is his to bind and to loose. That is, as an apostle, Peter is going to be in the position of spelling out the picture of who is in the kingdom and who isn't. If you want to understand what real faith looks like, what Jesus was about, what it means to be his disciple, it is Peter and the other apostles that you're going to go to find out what that's all about. And he is qualified to do that because God is at work in his understanding. And this is, in fact, true of all the apostles. This fits with the theme that we see as Jesus is dealing with the apostles on several occasions. He tells them that the power of God, the power of the Spirit of God, is going to be at work in their understanding as they carry out their task as his representatives. Most importantly is what we sometimes refer to as the upper room discourse in the Gospel of John. This is the night Jesus is going to be arrested. This is after Judas has left, and John records a very long talk that Jesus has with the apostles, explaining to them that he is going away and talking quite a bit about the role that they are going to play now that he is leaving. And so a couple of important things he says to them. One of the things is in John 14:26, he says, "But the Advocate, the Holy Spirit, whom the Father will send in my name, he will teach you all things and bring to your remembrance all that I said to you. I think this is really important. It's a very important statement. The Holy Spirit is going to teach the apostles all things, and he is going to play the crucial role of bringing to their remembrance all that Jesus said to them. That's going to be their job, after all. They're going to be witnesses. They're going to go out and teach what Jesus taught and explain what Jesus' life was all about. So here's Jesus saying to them, the Spirit of God is going to be at work as you are going out to tell people about what I'm all about. The Spirit of God is going to be at work in your understanding so that you will remember what I taught. And I think the implication is not just remember it, but understand it. Because the Spirit is going to teach them all things. In John 15:26, he says, when the Advocate comes, whom I will send to you from the Father, that is, the Spirit of truth who proceeds from the Father, he will bear witness of me, and you will bear witness also, because you have been with me from the beginning. Here again, Jesus is very, very clearly spelling out that picture. You are going to be my witnesses. You've been there. You've seen it all. You've heard what I've taught. You've seen what I've done. It is going to be your task to go out and explain this to people. And along with you, the Spirit of God is going to be testifying as well. And I think we could see that in several ways. I mean, the Spirit of God is teaching them so that they are in a position to explain clearly to us what Jesus is about. And we also see that the Spirit was at work in the miraculous signs that they did. Just as the work of God in the miracles of Jesus testified that God was with Jesus, therefore the same thing is happening with the apostles, that the work of the Spirit was testifying that God was with their message as well. So we see a picture here then that the apostles are going to be the representatives, the witnesses to Jesus' teaching. They're going to teach what he taught. They're going to tell us what he said. And their understanding is going to be informed by the power of the Spirit of God working with them. And not only the things that Jesus taught, not only are they going to be looking back to the things that they learned from him, but the Spirit is going to teach them all things, it says. And that's why Jesus says in John 16:12, I have many more things to say to you, but you cannot bear them now. But when he, the Spirit of truth, comes, he will guide you into all the truth. For he will not speak on his own initiative, but whatever he hears, he will speak. And he will disclose to you what is to come. He shall glorify me, for he shall take of mine and shall disclose it to you. So the apostles are essentially going to be prophets. Not only are they witnesses to what Jesus had said and taught, but the Spirit of God is going to pass on more information to them, and so that they can speak about what is to come and fully explain what it is that Jesus was about, which explains to us why when we look at the work of the apostles, they very much explain the teaching of Jesus, but then they also have some things to say to us that Jesus himself never said. So the Spirit of God would be revealing the things of Jesus, the Christ, to them, and they in turn would be teaching those things to us. So this is the picture that Jesus paints of the apostles. They were going to be supernaturally empowered representatives of Jesus. They would be empowered to remember, understand, and teach what Jesus taught. They would be like prophets, receiving further revelations from the Spirit of God. And because of their experience and God-given understanding, they would have the authority to speak for Jesus, to tell the church what it should believe and do. The thing that hits home to me is that Jesus was very aware of those believers who would come later. He's very aware that this is only a beginning with these men that he has in front of them, of him. On the last night in the upper room, Jesus prays this. He has been praying that the Father would care for and preserve the apostles there, the men that are there in front of him. And then he says in 17:20, I do not ask in behalf of these alone, but for those also who believe in me through their word, that they may all be one. So he's praying for the apostles who are there in front of him, but then he turns his attention to us, the ones who believe in Jesus through the testimony of the apostles. And he prays for the Father to care for us as well, that we all might be one, essentially that you and I might be together with Peter and James and John in our faith, in our understanding of God, in our commitment to Christ and his teaching. Jesus clearly has in mind, as he is preparing to leave this world, that his work will go on through the ministry of the apostles, and that many would believe through their testimony. Okay, so to me, the most interesting example of this is found in the story of doubting Thomas in John 20. Jesus had appeared to the apostles after the resurrection, but Thomas wasn't there. So we read in John 20:24, but Thomas, one of the 12, called Didymus, was not with them when Jesus came. The other disciples, therefore, were saying to him, we have seen the Lord. But he said to them, unless I shall see in his hands the imprint of the nails, and put my finger into the place of the nails, and put my hand into his side, I will not believe. And after 8 days again, his disciples were inside, and Thomas with them. Jesus came, the doors having been shut, and stood in their midst, and said, peace be with you. Then he said to Thomas, reach here your finger, and see my hands, and reach here your hand, and put it into my side, and be not unbelieving, but believing. Thomas answered and said to him, my Lord and my God. Jesus said to him, because you have seen me, have you believed? Blessed are they who do not see and yet believe. So, obviously, the part we're interested in is that response that Jesus has to Thomas at the end, that blessed are they who do not see and yet believe. Now, let me be clear about what Jesus is not saying to Thomas here, as far as I'm concerned. He is not saying, blessed are those who don't need any evidence or reason to believe, but just believe anyway. Here, Thomas, you wanted some reason to believe in this stuff. That was bad. Blessed are the people who just believe it anyway. They get told and say, oh, okay, I'll buy that. Now, that's a blessed person. Well, that's not what Jesus is saying. It couldn't possibly be what Jesus is saying, I think, because we already know in the Gospel of John the importance that Jesus gives to the miracles as a sign from God that he is indeed the Messiah. And he has already pointed to the greatest of the signs that would be done would be the resurrection. The miracles are intended to be testimony from God that Jesus is the Christ. In other words, the miracles are evidence. They are reasons to believe that Jesus is the Messiah, and they are intended to be evidence and reasons to believe. So that can't be what Jesus is saying, is the really blessed people are the ones who don't need any evidence, because that's irrational. To have no reason to believe something is not a good idea. But what is Thomas's situation? His situation is like ours. He hasn't personally seen Jesus alive. He only has the testimony of the apostles that they saw Jesus alive. And that's exactly our situation. We haven't seen Jesus alive, but we have the testimony of the apostles that he rose from the dead. So I think Thomas's response is kind of understandable. This is a pretty amazing story that the apostles are telling. Somehow you guys must have gotten something wrong somehow. You had a bad day, ate something bad, or having indigestion or something, and you thought you saw something. But that's, I need a little something more to go on, he's saying. What Jesus says to him applies to all of us. It is a blessing from God that one would not see the resurrection, but believe without seeing. That is, in the context, believe based on the testimony of the apostles. Why? Now, is Jesus saying that their testimony is not a good enough reason to believe? And so the Spirit has to give our belief a little extra boost? You know, okay, that testimony by itself would not be a good reason to believe, so the Spirit comes in and turns on the belief switch. You go, oh, I didn't have a good reason, but now I believe it anyway. Thanks, God. I needed that little boost to get over the top because, you know, pretty implausible as it stands, right? So thanks for getting me into that belief stuff. Again, that's not what he's getting at. But I think what he is acknowledging is that it is a blessing from God when our minds can understand the value of this testimony and our hearts are willing to see the value of this testimony. Processing the testimony of the apostles and arriving at belief is a treacherous process that could easily go wrong, mostly because of the kinds of minds and hearts that we have. So it is a blessing, a miracle, really, when it goes right. Okay, so let me kind of summarize what I'm seeing here. Jesus was strongly concerned about his chosen apostles from the beginning of his ministry until the end. He had his eye on them. He had his mind on them. He knew that they were a crucial part of what he was doing. First of all, I want to say there are two reasons why what Jesus did with and said to his apostles is of concern to us. I mean, why do we care about what he said to them? First of all, much of what he taught them applies to all believers. He was teaching them to believe the gospel and trust God more, and that is something we all need to do. So when he teaches them that they ought to be servants, we ought to be servants as well. There's no difference. They're in the same boat that we are, disciples of Jesus needing to learn what it means to follow God. But there's another aspect to what Jesus said to them that is of concern to us. And that's what he said about their unique role as his apostles and representatives. It's very relevant to us. We may not be apostles, but we are students of the apostles. Indeed, they were not apostles for their own sake. They were apostles for the sake of them, those whom they taught. Jesus gave them this role so that they might teach others. So, in part, they were apostles for your sake and my sake, because we are their students. So, what Jesus tells them about the nature of their job and their authority tells us how Jesus would want us to respond to them. He says that they would be supernaturally empowered to give testimony to what Jesus did and said, to receive further revelation, and to speak authoritatively as representatives of Jesus. That's what Jesus says is the role that he was giving them to play. That's why it's important to us to know what that role is. So, a couple of things I'd like to say about that. First of all, I want to talk about this distinction that I just made. That is, there are some things that Jesus told the apostles that apply to all of us. He was speaking to them as believers, and as believers we are in the same boat. And then there are some things that he told them that were uniquely for them in their role as apostles. This is a very important distinction, I think, for us to keep in mind as we read the Bible. For example, in what we were just looking at, you may have noticed that when we read the words that Jesus told the disciples, the Holy Spirit will bring to your remembrance all that I said to you. Well, who is the you in that statement? Who is it that the Spirit is going to bring to remembrance all the things that Jesus said? I have heard people interpret the you as you Christians. This is a promise to all of us. This is a promise that the Spirit would supernaturally fill our minds with Jesus' words. Some have taught that we should not prepare sermons, but should just rely on the Spirit, as Jesus promised. And you can probably tell that I don't follow that advice. And I think that you're much better off because I don't follow that advice. But, I mean, the idea is all that stuff in there about, you know, the Spirit will tell you what to say at the moment, and other things I didn't quote. All of those things, we have this tendency, want to take them and apply them to ourselves. I would argue that's a misunderstanding of what Jesus was getting at. At that point, he was talking to the apostles as apostles. They are the ones who had heard Jesus earlier, and they are the ones that the Spirit would help remember what Jesus had said, because they are the ones who were going to have the job of explaining to all of us what it was that Jesus was all about. I just think it's important because we are too quick sometimes to immediately apply verses to ourselves. We want a personal word from God, and so we immediately assume that whatever the Bible says is about us. But when Jesus says to the apostles, "The Spirit will bring my words to your remembrance," that may not be about us, but it is very relevant to us, because Jesus is telling us the nature of the role that the apostles were going to play, and thus what they ought to mean to us. I've told the story a million times that one of my first independent observations was in a Bible study where we were looking at a passage, and in the midst of that, I concluded that the passage was not a promise to Christians, but it was Paul talking about himself as a minister of the gospel, as an apostle, in other words. And it was quite shocking to me that I had been reading this wrong, and I won't go into it, but the group, when I shared my insight, was not happy with me for having done that. Because we want it to be about us. But the point I want to make here is that it is very, very important to you and me whether or not the apostles really are what Jesus describes them to be. Because if you think about it, this means that we can't really take the option of saying, "Oh, I like Jesus, but I don't like what the apostles did to Jesus' simple message," which is something that you hear actually a fair amount. There are people who would say, "Well, I like Jesus because he's all about love and acceptance and that stuff." But then when you read, the rest of the New Testament, it's religion and rules and all kinds of stuff, and I don't buy that stuff. Well, if we're going to say, "Oh, I really like the Jesus that is revealed in the Gospels," then we don't really have that as an option. Because the Jesus who is revealed in the Gospels would not accept that kind of thinking. The Jesus in the Gospels is majorly concerned with preparing his apostles to carry on, to teach with the authority of Jesus himself. He's saying, "You're going to remember what I said, the Spirit is going to teach you and bring you new understanding, and you're going to have the authority to speak for me." That's what he clearly says in the Gospels. So we can deny that Jesus said it, or we can say that somehow Jesus obviously got it wrong or something like that, but we can't really embrace the idea that I accept the teaching of Jesus and not the apostles, because he didn't really leave us that option. That's a major part of his work was to prepare these men to take on the teaching role after he left. Finally, I would like to talk a little bit about this idea of believing based on testimony. This is where we really, especially in our age, in the mindset of our age, where we really come up against a problem. I mean, you and I are basically saying that we believe what these guys wrote thousands of years ago and are basing our lives on it. Jesus understood the difficulty. He said, "Blessed is he who has not seen, the one who must depend on the testimony of the apostles and yet still believes." It's a hard thing. It's not an easy thing to arrive at that place. The modern world, I think, tends to look at us as somewhat naive for believing this testimony. Can a rational person believe in resurrection from the dead just because some ancient people wrote in a book that they saw it happen? I mean, is that really enough reason to accept this very implausible story about a God in the sky, and Jesus comes, born of a virgin, crucified, rises again, floats up into heaven, and miracles and healing and all that stuff. Can I really buy all that stuff because somebody said that it happened in a book that was written a long time ago? For better or worse, we in our culture are all children of the philosophers that arose out of the Enlightenment and so on. People like David Hume, who had a huge impact on our culture. Hume had a lot to say about this kind of issue, about what we can know and what we can't know and what we should believe. He said, "When anyone tells me that he saw a dead man restored to life, I immediately consider with myself whether it be more probable that this person should either deceive or be deceived, or that the fact which he relates should really have happened." It's interesting that he chooses the example of testimony about a man who was raised from the dead. It occurred to me to wonder whether he could have been thinking about the apostles and Jesus and their testimony, but I'm sure that's not what he had in mind. Okay, so now I don't understand Hume greatly. I'm not here to talk about Hume because I don't know that I could claim to fully understand all his arguments, but basically, he would argue that the universal experience of mankind is so against the idea of resurrection that no person could be rationally obliged to believe such testimony. It has to be, if you think about it, it has to be more probable that they're lying or that they're just mistaken than that a thing like resurrection would happen. Because look around, resurrection, that never happens. So obviously it didn't happen back then either. It seems to me, from my perspective, though, that Hume has stacked the deck. And the reason I'm talking about Hume here is just because I think this is a very important issue for us, especially in the world that we live in. He says, "I immediately consider which is more probable." But the question is, what is the worldview from which Hume evaluates the probability of these events? How rational are the tools that he is using to evaluate the rationality of the gospel? He makes it sound like it's a fairly simple task. I just consider universal human experience, and the answer is obvious, which is more probable. But the question is, how has he arrived at his understanding of universal human experience? The Bible would say that God has made himself known to us, but that we were unwilling to know him. That is, that there is a strong component of the will, of whether I choose or do not choose to accept what is rationally coherent in front of me. We have willfully set aside the rational reasons for believing in God, the Bible would say, I think. And then, sure, once we have rejected the knowledge of God and have constructed a worldview where God is not a prominent player, sure, you tell me a story about someone rising from the dead, and that's not probable in the world that I have created in my mind where there is no God to do such a thing. This theme has come up several times in the last weeks, the idea that how we respond to evidence is influenced by our will, by what we want to believe. Because we've been looking at the reasons that Jesus would give for why we should believe in him. And I think we could sum up what Jesus would say about this like this. Jesus would say to you and me that we should believe that he is the Messiah because of the reliable testimony of the apostles to Jesus' miracles, the wisdom of his teaching, and his fulfillment of Old Testament prophecy. Again, four things. He would say, he would point to the reliable testimony of the apostles, to the miracles of Jesus, and to the wisdom of his teaching, and to the fulfillment of Old Testament prophecy in his ministry. Well, the problem is that most modern thinkers don't find those reasons compelling. They don't trust such testimony. They refuse to believe in miracles. They don't find Jesus' teaching wise because Jesus does believe in all that stuff. And they don't believe in prophecy and deny that Jesus fulfilled anything. And I keep coming back to the same point. The fact that modern people don't find these things convincing doesn't mean that they are objectively unconvincing. We evaluate the claims of Jesus from a worldview that has already denied that such things can be. The question is whether we were rationally justified in having that worldview to begin with. To put it simply, do we see the absence of God in the world because that's the way it is, or because that's the way we want it to be? Jesus would say that there are good and compelling, objectively compelling reasons to believe that he is the Christ. But we have to be willing to let the evidence take us where it is going. Once again, it all comes back to repentance. So there's more that I could say about that, but maybe I'll just open it up to you at this point, and maybe we can talk about that topic a little bit if you want to, or whatever you want, whatever questions you might have.
Hi.
Hi.
I'm curious to know your thoughts on, given what you said about some of the Bible passages applying specifically to the apostles, what does that do to the Great Commission?
Yes.
Because it says it's to the 11.
Right.
But what are the implications of, I mean, now the apostles are all dead, so how do we continue to confront people with their testimony?
Right. Well, let me quote that again so that we know what we're talking about. This is in Matthew 28. The whole thing, Jesus says, all authority has been given, this is Matthew 28:18. All authority has been given to me in heaven and on earth. Go, therefore, and make disciples of all the nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father and the Son and the Holy Spirit, teaching them to observe all that I commanded you, and lo, I am with you always, even to the end of the age. Well, I think that the Great Commission, the way I would understand it, is that it has a specific and a general, it has a specific point and a general application. I think it is aimed at his apostles, that this is the commission that he has given them. This is the task that they were going to have from the beginning, teaching them to observe all that I commanded you. I mean, this is another way of saying, you're going to be my witnesses, you're going to go out and tell them what I told you. And so I think it is aimed at them. But when we understand the reasons for Jesus sending them out to do that, that the goal is for the message of Jesus to find its way to call out a people for God who respond to that message and say, yes, I want the life that Jesus is offering, we can see that just because I don't have the authority that the apostles do, that doesn't change the fact that it ought to be of interest to me that Jesus have further disciples through the ministry of the apostles who have explained what he commanded. So that's why, I mean, that's why I'm here talking from this book, because what we have in this book is the testimony of the apostles about what Jesus was doing. So the distinction is, I think, that implicit in what Jesus is saying to them is all this stuff about authority that I don't have. I mean, that's why we have questions after the thing is, the issue is whether I have accurately described what it is that the apostles are telling us about what Jesus said. So the authority rests with the ones who were commissioned to explain, to report to us what Jesus did and to explain what he's about. So that's what we're looking at. But implicit in that, I couldn't really be one of those disciples if then I turned around and said, okay, I think that's enough. You know, now I'm in, we can forget the rest of them. I mean, the implicit in it is this idea that I ought to want others. I mean, Paul can't go make new disciples. James or John or Peter can't go make new disciples, but we can point them to this and say, here, you ought to be a disciple of Jesus through the testimony of those that he commissioned to do that. So I know that's a long answer, but I think both of those things are there. But it's important to make that kind of a distinction, I think, because I think we can go wrong in thinking somehow that Jesus' last message was... Okay, so I've used this analogy before, and it's really offensive. So you just need to be prepared for the offensive analogy that I'm going to use here. But I think it can be sort of fitting. There's the Amway picture, which is basically, I become a member of Amway so that I can go out and make other members of Amway, so that they can go out and make other members of Amway. That the Great Commission can be interpreted as if you're a Christian, you don't have any other task in life than evangelism. And I don't think that's actually true. I think God has called us to a variety of things. We are all evangelists in the sense that we are called to live out our faith and be prepared, as Peter says, to explain what's going on with this stuff. But it is not necessarily every Christian's task, I don't think, to give up. You know, it's not like, well, I better not have children because I can't stay home and take care of my kids. I have to be out evangelizing. I mean, this people can point to the Great Commission and treat it as if it was the only thing that we're supposed to do. Whereas I think, like I said, it is instead the marching instructions for the apostles, but it tells us the importance of the gospel such that every Christian ought to see their life as fitting into that overall picture somewhere. So, anyway, yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ron. I have a question about Matthew 16 and Peter's confession. When he says, they're wandering around up in Caesarea Philippi, and he says, who do people say the Son of Man is? And their response is John the Baptist. Some people say Elijah. Some people say Jeremiah, or one of the prophets. And then he says, but who do you say that I am? Is he asking two different questions? Because as I read that, 13, he's asking, so when you're out and about in the people and you get in one of these conversations about the Messiah, who are people talking about? Who do they think, what's up with that? Who do they think he's going to be? And then, and their answer are these. But then he says, but who do you say that I am? So his reference to the Son of Man in 13 is, he's not claiming, he's not saying me when he says Son of Man, right?
Well, okay, so yeah, I understand your question.
Okay.
And I think what you're proposing is a legitimate option.
Okay.
If you were to take, I mean... if you were to interpret Son of Man as, let's replace it with the word Messiah,
okay,
and he was to right. say, who do people say the Messiah is? That would sound like what he's saying is, who would they nominate to be the Messiah? Mm-hmm. And so their answer could be, well, some people think John the Baptist is the Messiah. Some think Elijah is going to be the Messiah when he comes, and like so. That's possible. I'm open to that as a possibility. I think you can interpret it the other way, though. That is, who do people say that I am? And he calls himself the Son of Man. In the sense that we do know, for example, that Herod, for one, if I'm remembering this correctly, when he heard the story, you know, he executed John the Baptist. When he heard the story about the miracles that Jesus was doing, he thought maybe John the Baptist had come back. Okay, so, and if you talk about, to answer to the question, who do people say that I am, and they say Elijah, that would be understandable in terms of there is this expectation that Elijah was going to come back, not that Elijah would be the Messiah. So their people's answer could be, he's saying, what people are saying to me is, well, you know, I don't think he's the Messiah, but he sure is doing some nifty stuff, so maybe he's Elijah that we're expecting. Jesus, your master is Elijah. So I could understand it that way as well, and that would be the way I would be inclined to take it, because I'm not sure that I can think of a counterexample. Well, maybe I could, but most of the time when Jesus uses the phrase Son of Man, I would argue that it's synonymous with I. It's a way of describing himself. But I can see how you could go the other way. Do you have a reason why you would go that way rather than the other way?
Well, first of all, it struck me as odd that they would say, equating him with John the Baptist, seeing as how they hang out together.
Mm-hmm.
They're two different people sitting on opposite sides of the table having a meal, and then saying, you're him. And they look at you like you're crazy. No, I'm not him. He's him. I'm me. You see what I'm saying?
Right, right.
And the other thing is, Peter says, you are the Christ, the Son of the living God. Also titles for the Messiah. Why didn't he just say, you?
Well, but notice, the second question that he asks is, who do you say that I am? Mm-hmm. He didn't ask, who do you say that the Messiah is?
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, even the way you put it before is he was asking two different questions.
Mm-hmm.
Who do people say the Messiah is? They nominate various people. Who do you say that I am? Part of the reason is that's a little bit strange, that connection of statements. I mean, it seems like what he would say to them is, who do you say the Messiah is? At which point they would say, you. So I'm kind of more inclined to see it as basically two ways of saying, what are other people saying about me, and what do you say about me? And that's kind of where I would land right now.
So, Ron, I'm in John, I guess it's 13:34.
Yes.
A new commandment I give to you, that you will love one another even as I have loved you.
Yes.
That you also love one another. By this, all will know that you are my disciples, even if you love one another.
Right.
Does that fall into what of the four things does that fall into, that you were given four different?
Okay, well, oh, because you're saying men will know that you're my disciples, so he's giving that as a kind of evidence.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, well, it doesn't fit into those four, because I see it as a slightly, it's related kind of idea, but
I guess what I'm asking is, could it be a fifth?
Yeah, but I understand what he's saying there a little bit differently, although I'm open, maybe I'm not seeing it right, but I don't see him as saying, you love one another, and so everybody will believe that I'm the Messiah. It's, I think what he's saying is that I have come here to put down my life on the behalf of my people. I am all about loving, doing good for the people of God, my followers. That's what I came to do, is to sacrifice myself for them. So when you love one another, when you love your fellow believer, then you are showing yourself to be my disciple, because you are reflecting in your life the same values that I have, the same love for my people. You have that same love. So it's evidence of something, but it's not evidence that God sent Jesus. It's evidence that the disciples are indeed representing what Jesus was about, or something like that. So, I mean, it's evidence of a sort, so it's kind of related in that way. And I guess you could call it a fifth, but I'm just thinking, you know, my mind, I slice and dice, you know, categorize things and stuff, so I just had a little bit different category. But you're right, it's an essential thing that he's talking about there. I mean, and maybe I'm not Maybe I'm not understanding that right, but that's how I would see it right now.
So if the Spirit works in us, but he doesn't ex-nihilate ideas into my head, presumably he has me either observe reality and make conclusions about reality that under his influence he gets my moral decrepitude out of the way and I can make correct conclusions. And that should be sufficient, according to Romans. But he also had 12 guys be taught of Jesus in various ways and spread them out. And through their agency, I can be exposed to to these ideas, which under the Spirit's influence, it's almost like a pattern matching in my brain. I can go, aha, okay, yeah, that makes sense. So you got these 12 guys who either write or teach or both, and their students might record what, like in the case of Mark, I guess, was supposed to be Peter's secretary. And then you've got this period of time where at some point somebody decides that we need this, that there's some kind of the special power that Jesus, they think, gave Peter needs to be, because there was no way for, you know, Gutenberg hadn't been born yet, and there wasn't any easy way.
That's been the world's problem all along, I can tell you that.
Yeah, Gutenberg College wasn't around. So, no, I mean the guy, right?
Yeah.
So there was no way for their writings easily to be transmitted for long periods of time, and so the only way that people could be exposed to this information, which is redundant because we've got creation to observe. We shouldn't need it. It's an additional Benny that God gives us, but they didn't have that. So the Catholic Church, one of the arguments they make is that, well, how else were these people supposed to get good information, given that there was no way for the apostles' writings to be transmitted, except for, obviously, God would have wanted this special power to be moved from person to person, so we've got the papacy and that kind of thing. So I'm thinking, looking at the history of the Catholic Church, that there's that argument is really suspect because of all the doo-doo that that has come out from that institution. There's some good stuff has come out of it, but some really terrible stuff. So what was God thinking, do you think? If you can think yourself after him, how was he?
I would be a good one to ask.
How was this information before Gutenberg, before people were rich enough to hire a monk to transcribe everything, when you've got these fallible people who I think just the evidence of what came out of them suggests the Spirit was not involved, I mean, was not organizing their thoughts for them, perhaps even the other guy. How was it just that it was supposed to be because it made sense when the apostles were moving on to train people and to say, look, I go out and tell them what I tell you, and sometimes they got it right and sometimes they didn't. Was God just expecting in general this information, some of which is good, some of which is bad, is going to go out, and the people who have the Spirit of God sort the wheat from the chaff? They do this pattern matching thing of, you know, the stuff about indulges and stuff, nah, I don't think so. But the stuff about I need the mercy of God, and Jesus was God's way of satisfying justice without taking it out on me, that they would say, yeah, I'm not this indulgence stuff I don't get, but this other stuff, that makes sense to me. Do you think that's the way it was happening? I can't think of any other way.
Well, partly. I mean, it could be. Part of what seems clear to me in the way that God does things is that God is very patient and quite willing for the process that we go through as individuals and as a people collectively, that we go through a lot of thrashing around and sorting things out in the process. So I think many of those people along the way, they would have looked at the adult indulgences thing, and they might, from a heart that was truly inspired by a desire to know God and to follow God, would look at that and say, well, you know, that's not the way I would have done it, but if that's what God's doing, I mean, you know, that's... Now, you know, these guys seem a little greedy, but there must be a more godly way to do indulgences if that's what God is all about. I mean, there's room for all kinds of stuff like that. I guess what I'm saying is I don't think God is all that concerned necessarily about how quickly we get the right answers to these questions. It's in the process of thrashing this stuff out, our hearts are sorting out, are we willing to be instructed by the truth, and so on. So, you know, I've said before, and I really think about it this way, that the revelation that God has made in the scriptures to this small group of people at a particular place in history and then and in the world, and then its dissemination around and the distortions it went through and the corrections and all of that stuff, that God, the individual destiny of each of us is determined by whether we are sanctified at heart by God such that we are open to admitting the truth about ourselves and God and so forth to the extent that we have knowledge to interact with. And some people have a lot of knowledge and some people don't have much knowledge, but each of us individually is going to stand before God and either be recognized as a person whose heart was open to God or one that was not. But in the weave of history, we have this intricate process where God's ideas have gotten out there and people have wrestled with them, and then we come back and argue, wait a minute, that can't be what he meant, it must be like this. And you know, I mean, if we grant that the Reformation was a pretty good thing when it happened, that was quite a ways down line before that came along. So, and even in the model of that has a very high view of the role of the early church fathers and that kind of stuff, we all have to kind of recognize, even if we have a real high view of that stuff, well, yeah, okay, that guy, he was coming along. He had some good ideas, but he didn't quite have it right yet because, you know, we've decided, well, it was these councils here that kind of pulled this stuff together and made it so that it was all okay. So even if you have a high view of the authority and of the church councils and rulers and stuff along the way, we have to recognize it was a process. I mean, nobody can get away from the fact that it was a process. And so I just think we have to recognize God's okay with process. And that's helpful to us as we, in two ways, as we look back at history, we can think, you know, I don't have to think of this as this unerring march towards truth that happened within a couple of years and we had it all nailed. I mean, that's just not the way it worked. And it's also helpful as we think of our own lives. I mean, each of us is in process as we're doing this, and we have some things right and we have some things wrong, but the question is my heart open to God or not? And if it is, that will work itself out in my life as I encounter teaching and issues in my life and people I have to forgive and face the fear of my own death and what do I think is coming afterwards and all of that stuff. So yeah, it's a real mess. I mean, I think you look at church history, it's a real mess. And I really like what David has said, David Crabtree, that I just think it's so important to remember that what we know as history is kind of these are the big movements that happened, you know, the big important people that got big enough to be noticed and have an impact on things. But when we get to stand before God and the whole story is revealed to us, I think we're all going to find out that most of the important stuff that happened would never even got recorded. I mean, you know, we'd think about, you know, Luther had this great insight that changed the world. There were probably these guys all along the way that understood things 10 times better than Luther did. But they were, you know, they were in this little church and they didn't want to cause trouble. And the pastor would say stuff and they'd say, okay. And every now and again, they'd go up and talk to him and say, you know, I was looking at that passage. I think it might be saying something like this. And the pastor will go, well, I don't know. That's not what I've been taught. And they go, oh, okay. So, you know, so we find out that there have been these theological geniuses all throughout history that we don't know anything about, because God's quite content to do things that way, I think. So that's how I would look at it. There's no one answer to that. It's that and a million different ways. Everybody's story is different. But God has been quite happy for our understanding of this stuff to kind of grow and get odd little branches that have to be chopped off, and, you know, that's... We have to be happy with that. If we're not happy with that, then we're going to find our own lives and looking back at the history of the church and everything, we're going to find that real frustrating because it's just messy, really, really messy. Up with meths, that's what I say. Is that it? Okay, thanks.